From the great state of Ohio, Buckeye Firearms Association presents Keep and Bear Radio, fighting for Second Amendment rights, calling out media lies, and telling the gun grabbers to come and take it. Now, Keep and Bear Radio.
I'm Dean Reek, Executive Director of Buckeye Firearms Association, and I'm joined by Rob Sexton, BFA's Legislative Affairs Director. Hi, Rob. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Dean. I'm glad to be back with you.
Well, Rob, it's been about 4 months since we last had you on the podcast. Other than working on all the election stuff, what have you been up to?
Well, you know what? The primary election obviously was a major focus. You know, and of course, I was part of the endorsement committee for Buckeye Firearms, just like you. And so we had lots of homework to do to get through all the endorsements and the likes. That took up a lot of our time. And so now, I think the State House is about to get back going again, and we've got a lot of priorities still sitting on the table. So I've been working on trying to lay the groundwork to salvage something out of what has been, let's face it, a fairly dysfunctional session.
And do you think with the general election coming up that we're going to get some stuff done? Because, you know, the inter-house fighting is still going on. We have everyone's geared up for the general election now. And there just seems to be an awful lot of chaos. And it's not just Ohio. It's all over the country. So, you know, are we anticipating that we're going to get some stuff done this year?
Yeah, and that's a great question, you know, and I think it remains up in the air, right? There becomes a point in any session where you get close to election and you know it's harder to get stuff done, so you have to make a decision. You know, do I want to lay the groundwork for next session and just understand that's where we are, or do I want to keep fighting and try to pull something out of our hat? You know, in the past, Buckeye Firearms Association has gotten things done during the lame duck session. So could we pull out one of those moves again? Those are the evaluations that always have to be done. What's different is what you alluded to, and that is the legislature, the Ohio House specifically in this case, is just really hard to analyze in terms of how things are going to come out. We've got a lot of factions and a lot of rivalries, and it's just made it hard to advance any productive legislation for any movement, including, of course, the Second Amendment.
While the primary election is done, it's in the books, and the state did not burst into flames, we survived. And actually, Rob, we did pretty well. I did a little math on this, and it looks like about 92% of our endorsed candidates won. Just overall on the primary, what was your impression?
Well, I felt good about people we endorsed. Obviously, the 92% that won, you know, I'm very pleased with that and glad that we could be of help to them. They're all good Second Amendment warriors, you know, and have great records. For the few that we endorsed that did not win, you know, I think it's important for us to say we don't endorse people based on who we think are going to win. We endorse people based on their voting records and based on their positions on the issues that matter, and hopefully they win. We try to do what we can to help them win, but sometimes, you know, the ones with the best record don't win the primary election, and I don't think that's cause for us to say, gosh, we backed the wrong horse. I think sometimes you have to stick with your friends who vote your way, because if you don't back those that vote your way, what incentive would they ever have in the future to do so?
So, Rob, I got a lot of questions and a few gripes from some of our supporters about, you know, who we endorsed and why we gave a certain grade to this person, a different grade to that person. And I had to do some explaining, and this comes up in virtually every election, on the fact that we're a nonpartisan, one-issue organization. And what I've found, there are a lot of organizations out there that just kind of slap grades on candidates based on how they feel on a particular day, or they toss out endorsements like candy. But we really don't do that. We do, as you say, we, you know, look at grades, we look at surveys, we look at how they voted, and we have voting records going back over 20 years, and we focus on gun rights only. And the reason is we want the information to be usable. We're not just a generic conservative organization or a generic Republican organization. And I think that that's really important. What are your thoughts on that?
I totally agree. I've been a part of a lot of nonprofit advocacy organizations over the years, both as a volunteer and a staffer. And BFA by far has the most intensive endorsement process I've ever been a part of. Being you specifically are the one that keeps the record of all these votes all these years. I mean, we can go back a long way and spot what people did on the key votes involving the Second Amendment. And so we have a process that's based on experience. And, you know, sometimes you'll have a 50-50 ball, you know, where we could go one way or the other, and those decisions can be hard to make. But our positions are not based on whether I like a guy or he likes BFA or he likes the Second Amendment. They're based on their voting records and the positions they take. And that is how it should be. Even when the guy you endorse doesn't win, or even when the guy you endorse is not the most popular guy.
Yeah. And if you look at, I'll just throw one organization out there just at random. You know, Black Lives Matter, for example. Now, this is an organization that's on the left. You know, they're not going to agree with us on anything. But, you know, here's an organization, and they're supposed to be about civil rights. That's basically what that organization was founded to deal with. But if you look at their website, if you look at what they do, they're into, you know, gender issues and student loans. They're anti-Trump. They have a Marxist philosophy. They don't really stick to a core mission. They're sort of all over the map, basically just fighting Republicans. And you see that with other organizations as well. It doesn't happen on the right as much, but it does, in fact, happen. And we've just never done that. We like to stick to our mission. And in my view, that maximizes our effectiveness, because when we give you a grade, you know that that's about gun rights. It's not about anything else. And sure, you know, not everybody is a one-issue voter. And that's fine if you want to factor in the economy and immigration and abortion, whatever else that concerns you. But our grade has to be pure. Otherwise, our information means nothing. Right?
Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah. And you're like, and, you know, going back to this voting record that we keep track of, those votes are votes that mattered in terms of gun rights. And this is a very appropriate topic you've brought up. The most pivotal vote that members of the Ohio General Assembly have taken during this session was the vote that put issue one on the ballot back in August. And that vote, of course, would have required 60% to pass any change to the state constitution. And so putting that on the ballot was a priority for Buckeye Firearms Association for one simple reason. It is the best defense against the greatest vulnerability that we have. If the anti-gun forces in this country are ever going to win in Ohio, that's where they're going to win. They're going to put something on the ballot to change our constitution. And at that point, it only takes 50.1%. It is a race that's all about how much money you have. And so to get on board a campaign to make changing the constitution harder than just changing the regular law was the best possible way to protect us against that vulnerability. So that's why that legislation was a top priority for us. And we had a handful of members of the House who voted no. We also had clearly stated in writing multiple times that this was our top priority vote for the year. So, you know, when it comes time to grade candidates, if you don't hold people accountable for the votes that they take, then they'll never respect when you say something is a priority ever again. And so this election was tricky because it included that issue Of course, it included a very messy U.S. Senate primary. And so it, for our endorsement committee, things were complicated and made us work hard. But ultimately, I think we made the right decision on every one of those things. I felt good how we came out as far as who got the endorsements and what grades they received. And I just don't know of another organization that puts that much evidence into the decisions they make on each of these races.
So, Rob, you brought up the next topic that I wanted to discuss, and that's the U.S. Senate race. And this was a race where we endorsed one candidate and then another candidate won. So, you know, we endorsed Frank LaRose, but Bernie Moreno eventually won that. Now, I just wanted to discuss this a little bit because a lot of people asked, you know, why did you endorse LaRose? And the reason was very simple. It had nothing to do with how we felt about other candidates. I mean, Bernie Moreno got an A grade from us. You know, he did a survey. It turned out just fine. We gave him a good grade. But Frank LaRose is somebody we know, we've known for a long time. We have actual votes. And in this particular instance, we decided to endorse. So it's not necessarily a reflection on Bernie Moreno. That's just how we did it. And the thing to remember is who is on the blue side of the ticket in November. You know, whoever won is going to go up against Sherrod Brown. So let's just talk about this, because Brown is definitely anti-gun, right?
I mean, 100%.
He's supported AR bans, magazine bans, red flag. I mean, my impression is he's sort of an old-fashioned Democrat, what you might call a blue dog Democrat or a country Democrat. So he's not, I mean, he's a nice guy and all that, but he's just not a gun guy. And he's definitely anti-gun. So the whole point of this race is we've got to get Sherrod Brown out of there.
100%. Sherrod Brown must go in order to protect the Second Amendment in the U.S. Senate. And so it even is a step more important than just Brown's record during his time in the Senate. The control of the United States Senate is up for grabs. And so, you know, if the Republican were to unseat Sherrod Brown, then the Republicans could take the U.S. Senate. And hey, look, this past year, Biden was able to get some level of gun control through the U.S. Senate. Sherrod Brown voted for that bill. So while we don't always get involved in federal races, to your point, this seemed like the one we had to because of its import, Sherrod Brown, terrible record, the pivotal nature of the Senate itself and who controls it. So then it really got down to a question of, are we going to endorse someone in the primary? And for those who support Bernie Moreno, our discussion was really less about Moreno and more about what do you do when you've got a candidate with an entire career of an A-plus record or an A record, A-rated record, who has sought dialogue with the Second Amendment community throughout and just simply stayed an ally to the Second Amendment when that person is running against someone with no voting record at all. And so while we always knew that Moreno was going to be a well-funded candidate, and for that matter, we always knew that Matt Dolan was going to be a well-funded candidate, it really came down to how can you not reward a career of 100% voting record? And I think that was the thought that won the day. I don't want to, you know, we're talking inside baseball a little bit here, Dean, but the truth is this was a discussion for us, right? So we have people who support Bernie Moreno. We have people who support Frank LaRose, but ultimately the question came down to, what do you do about someone who has cast an entire career full of good Second Amendment votes and decisions when the other person has no voting record at all? I think that we can feel good about our decision because anyone knows at the General Assembly, if they vote right, that we're going to treat them based on their voting record. And I think that was important.
And this was a race that really garnered national attention. I mean, Moreno got the Trump endorsement, which I think was huge, and there was a lot of outside money. In fact, I read that a Democratic group put in, what, like over $2 million to support Marino because there was this theory that he was going to be the weaker candidate against Sherrod Brown. So there's a lot of strange stuff happening here, and there may have also been some Democrats voting in the Republican primary, which apparently you can do in Ohio because of the way that our primary system works. So, you know, everybody was focused on this race, not just in Ohio, but across the country.
Yeah, and both of those things you just brought up are important factors, right? So Democrat special interest groups put money behind Marino because in their estimation, he would be the easier candidate to defeat against Sherrod Brown. I don't know if they're right or wrong, but that's what occurred. And they encouraged Democrats to vote for Marino. Now, look, we don't base what we do based on what the Democrat groups do, right? I mean, the Democrats all thought Donald Trump was the one to back in 16, and that wound up biting him in the butt, you know, and Trump won the White House. So we don't base our decision on that kind of nonsense, but it really does show you just how messy this particular race was. But I think this is the right time for us to pivot, right? So the primary is over. Bernie Marino won. So now the question is, what can Second Amendment people do to support Second Amendment candidates? And clearly, Bernie Marino is a preferred alternative to Sherrod Brown.
Yeah. I mean, because that's right. It always turns out, I mean, there are always other things to vote on when the general election comes around, but let's be practical. It's going to be a Democrat versus a Republican. That's always the choice. And so when you know that one of those choices is absolutely anti-gun, that pretty much tells you which way you need to go. And as we've mentioned, you know, this is not just an Ohio thing. This is a national thing as well, because this plays a part in the Biden gun control agenda. If he gets reelected as president, he's probably going to continue a lot of what he's been doing, using the ATF to abuse power, you know, banks targeting gun sellers. And Rob, right before the podcast, you had sent me a link to this bill that they're trying to pass in California. Why don't you tell us about that? I mean, it's all about registration of firearms.
Yeah, well, yeah, and even a step worse than that. So to a lot of us, being forced to register guns would be the worst, other than just outright confiscation. Like, that would be as bad as it gets, right? So California, under the category of hold my beer, they're not going to just stay with registration being bad. So if registering your guns is bad, why don't we make them register their guns each and every year? And so that's exactly what California Senate Bill 1160 would do. And this bill actually got introduced last month, so it's not hot off the press. It's only got one sponsor, so there's, you know, likely not a lot of momentum behind this bill. So it would be easy to write off as, oh, every chamber has one lunatic fringe, right? Like, we've got Lauren Boebert, they got whatever this clown is, right? But in the end, crazy ideas that started in California are now the law of the land out there. You pay a tax when you buy ammunition now in California. And I'm old enough to remember when we thought that was a radical idea. So the next terrible idea has made a beachhead in the most expected state, California. And that idea would be that you have to register each gun you own every single year.
Yeah. And now I just glanced over it. I didn't read the whole bill, but my understanding is that if you don't register your firearm and you get caught, it's a $1,000 fine. Do you know what the registration fee is for every firearm?
I don't, but it's not cheap. I feel like it's a 3-digit number. I can't remember that, but in addition to the $1,000, it creates this enormous paper trail, which is everything you'd fear about registration to begin with. So let's say you registered 10 guns and one of your guns is your Glock 17. The next year you register 9, the government figures out your Glock 17 is not there. They're going to come out and ask you, where's your Glock 17? So then you're going to tell them, well, geez, I sold the Glock 17. Who'd you sell it to? Say they sold it to Dean Reek, sold it to his good friend, Rob Sexton. And then I didn't register that gun. They're going to come find me and ask me, where's the Glock 17? I mean, this is just setting up an ongoing, let me see your papers type of scenario. Is it likely to become law this session? No, but let me just remind our listeners that in California, you can move into someone's house when they're not home, and the law protects your right to be there more than the homeowner. So it's not beyond the pale of crazy for what's acceptable in California. And unfortunately, you know, once their brand of crazy becomes less crazy to them, it starts to migrate.
And this also would have the effect for ordinary people. Now, if you're rich, it doesn't matter, but if you're just an ordinary guy and you have a collection of firearms, let's say you have 100 firearms, if it costs $100 per firearm, right? That adds up to a significant amount of money. What's that? $10,000.
Yeah.
Is that right? So it would have the effect of basically telling people you really can't own a lot of guns. We don't want you to have a lot of guns. And then what do you do? Those guns have to go someplace. You're going to sell them to somebody else, and then there's a paper trail on that. And I read an article about it, and it basically came right out and said, yeah, we want a registry of firearms. We want to know who has them, how many they have, what they have. So they're not hiding any of that. They want statistics on all of it.
Yes. Yeah, they're not going to rest until they know where all the guns are, which now, all of our people have long said, the next step after that is once they know where they all are, they can come get them. And I think that's true. But under like Ohio's system, for example, we don't register firearms. They'd have to do quite a bit of paper trail to find out a gun you bought, if they could even find it. But once gun registration's on the books, the paper trail starts. If it's an annual thing, you know, then this idea that, well, you know, I casual sailed it over to someone, or I gave it to my son or my nephew, all that stuff would have to have a paper trail, or you'd be guilty of a crime. You know, the bottom line is the reality of gun control in this country is becoming more of a reality every day.
And I hate to point out the obvious, but who's going to obey those laws? I mean, are the gang members going to obey those laws? Are the repeat criminals, violent criminals, going to obey those laws? Or, you know, you're going to have them go in and register their firearms? You know, it becomes a huge burden on people who are going to follow those laws. And what would they do? What would they do with people who just decide not to follow the law? We've seen things like AR bans pass in other places with very low numbers on the people who are complying with those laws. So what's going to happen then? Well, I mean, it raises all kinds of really nasty possibilities on what California, on where they're really going with something like that. But the point of all of this, Rob, is that's why the Senate race is so important, because, you know, if you get one of those chambers and you control it, you can wield an awful lot of power.
Well, right. You know, you look at how one chamber of the Congress, being Democrat, was able to thwart President Trump's agenda during his one term, and how much the House has stood in the way of Biden's agenda. So the control of the U.S. Senate is a very important matter for, you know, overall, and certainly for the Second Amendment. So that's why this race matters. Our endorsement committee hasn't met yet to talk about endorsements for the general election yet, and that sort of thing, because that's really two processes for us. We do the primary, and then we gather again to talk about the general. So we haven't made up any formal decision. But I'll just tell you, you know, as one member of the committee, we're going to have to back Moreno, I think, right? That's going to be the upshot. Is if we want Sherrod Brown to go down, then we're going to have to do something to help that process along. So we'll be trying to help Moreno, I think. But of course, we'll be making that decision formally here in the next several weeks, I would imagine.
Well, and in another race that is going to be very important, and this doesn't get talked about a lot, but the Ohio Supreme Court.
Right.
There are three seats that are up this time. Right now on the court, there are four Republicans, three Democrats. And I kind of hate to point that out because, again, we're nonpartisan. Technically, we don't care what party they belong to. But the fact is, Democrats on courts tend not to support gun rights. And that's just the way it is. So it is. If the Ohio Supreme Court flips to a majority Democrat, we're going to have a problem. And Rob, why don't you just talk a little bit about that? Because there's so much about gun rights that depend on the courts as much as, or maybe sometimes even more than, what happens in the legislature.
Well, right. And, you know, we're under attack almost continuously at this point by Ohio's larger cities. Currently, Columbus and their mayor, Andy Ginther, really relishes being Ohio's most anti-gun mayor. It is a never-ending barrage of attacks on gun owners seeking to pass city ordinances that are gun control ordinances. Of course, all those are in direct contradiction to state law, Ohio's preemption law, which declares that only the state can set gun policy and that the cities have to live underneath that regime. That's been challenged before. It's now being challenged again, and it's not going to stop, right? Well, these cases ultimately wind up before the high court. And so the Supreme Court's going to have a say in what happens with the latest battery of gun control being proposed by Columbus or some other city. And one seat flip in the Ohio Supreme Court makes that a 4-3 Democrat court, and you could see the court strike down preemption. So that court, that those races are vital. And one other point, you know, you said, well, you know, hate to get partisan about it. Here's the thing. I'm ready for the day when we can say, hey, look, there's a Democrat that votes pro-gun, right? See, we're bipartisan. But the fact is, we're bipartisan. We welcome the next pro-gun Democrat. We're ready for it. It's just been a while since we've had. You and I both have been open about Governor Ted Strickland. I mean, when he was governor, he was very pro-gun. And so I don't feel like we have to apologize for seemingly being partisan. The fact is, we just simply respond to the voting records of the elected officials who come before us. And we're ready for the next pro-gun Democrat. But in the meantime, the Ohio Supreme Court is controlled by four Republicans who have a good record on guns. If it becomes 4-3 Democrat, I think that's in peril.
So there's an interesting story that's been in the news. One of these races has gotten, as one newspaper described it, a little spicy. So you have Cleveland Democrat Melody Stewart, who is currently on the court, and you have Cincinnati Republican Joe Dieters, who is on the court. Now, generally, when somebody's seat comes up during an election, they, if they want to remain on the court, they run for their own seat. Well, Joe Dieters kind of surprised people. He said, no, I'm not going to run for my seat. I'm going to try to knock off Melody Stewart and knock her off the court. So it came out that apparently there was a deal that he made with Governor DeWine. DeWine appointed him to the court. And to get his seat, to get that appointment, he had to agree to run against a Democrat and knock them off. So that's what he's doing. He's actually running against one of his fellow jurists, and he wants to knock her off the court. And she had a little zinger that appeared in a newspaper. She said, I've been a jurist for 17 years. My opponent has been a jurist for 17 minutes. Now, okay, if Trump had said that, that wouldn't have been any big deal, right? But when a Ohio Supreme Court justice says that, that's kind of the equivalent of bare-knuckled boxing, because generally they don't throw out zingers like that. So, you know, this race has gotten really interesting, and it's all about, you know, who's going to have the power in the court? Is it going to be Republicans? Is it going to be Democrats? And what, you know, what are your thoughts on all that? Because this may be the first time that we've seen someone try to knock somebody off in this way.
Yeah, I can't remember the last time it's been attempted. So if it has, it's just something I did not take note of. You know, I think the stakes are high. The court's 4-3. If Dieters were to knock off the Democrat, you know, you have the possibility of a 5-2 port even. So folks might be saying, well, why is that important? I'll tell you why it's important. Previously to this session, we had a 4-3 Republican court, right? But the Chief Justice was Maureen O'Connor, who sort of migrated her way into more moderate, rhino, lefty type positions as time went on. And so because it was a one seat majority, when Justice Connor flipped to join the Democrats on several items, then the court became effectively a 4-3 Democrat majority. So, you know, the one seat margin that we currently enjoy, it means that we're really depending on those pro-gun judges to be pro-gun on every single vote. And so Dieters capturing the seat would be important to the Second Amendment. My guess is, you know, Governor DeWine is going to have 8 years in office by the time he leaves. A lot of policy has been passed through the General Assembly and across his desk. And I think he would probably like to leave behind a court that would leave intact most of the conservative policies that the legislature has passed.
Yeah, and the courts, I think I read once, where, you know, when ordinary people are voting, they'll vote top of the ticket mostly. And when they get down to court races, whether it's appellate courts or Supreme Court or, you know, any judges whatsoever, there's a huge drop-off. It's half of what are voting on the top of the ballot candidates. Maybe it's even worse than that. And, you know, now that one of the changes they made, I think they just made this a couple of years ago, where the justices used to not reveal what party they belong to. They now do. So you'll see an R or a D after their name. And the votes went up because that carries some information with it. So I find that this is interesting because the courts are now starting to, I guess I would just have to say, playing politics a little bit more than they have previously in Ohio.
Yeah, I think that's true. And, you know, I referenced Judge Maureen O'Connor, who was the former Chief Justice. She just left after this past session. You know, she actually is the reason why Ohio is taking such a close look at how it will redistrict its congressional seats and how it will redistrict its state legislative seats. And honestly, what I really struggle with on that is this. We have elections. People win. And when those people win, they get to govern. That's how we've done it since day one. But the losers recently, that have been mostly the Democrats, have decided that the rules don't work for them. They want to change the rules. So O'Connor has joined this coalition, and her last 2 years as the chief judge, she tried to use the courts to force the Republicans, who won fair and square in power, you know, to rewrite the districts in favor of the party that did not win. And so having an extra seat on that court, in case somebody loses their way, the way that O'Connor did, I think that's good politics. And I think we haven't agreed with everything Mike DeWine has done as governor, that's for sure. But I'll say this, I think he got this one right. And this is something that'll ultimately be good for the Second Amendment.
And there's a ballot initiative that's underway right now on redistricting. I mean, they're collecting signatures, and if they get enough, it's going to appear on the November ballot. And Rob, that's for a constitutional amendment. You know, I'm not a big fan of constantly changing the Constitution. The Ohio Constitution has so much garbage in it that shouldn't belong there. This was one of our arguments back when we were trying to get the 60% threshold passed, because you have stuff in there like about casinos, specific locations where casinos can set up shop. That's not constitutional information, right? That's more about legislation or regulation, But that's what happens in Ohio. You run these ballot initiatives, you change the Constitution, and then what do? If you want to challenge that. That, I think, is a really serious issue here in this state.
I do, too, and that's precisely why we backed, failed issue one back from August. You know, we foresaw this very thing. So the Constitution is going to be rewritten in terms of how districts are decided. And it is a historical fact that the side with the most money wins predominantly on these races. And so this redistricting thing has been backed by Obama. It's been backed by Obama's Attorney General, Eric Holder, this movement to redo the lines and the redistricting in the states as a way to increase Democratic power. That's what we're looking at here in Ohio with this redistricting proposal, which I think we're likely to see on the ballot in November, in addition to Trump and Biden, Marino and Sherrod Brown, the Supreme Court justices, and now this likely overall this constitutional amendment to redraw the lines.
So, you know, in the meantime, Rob, we're gearing up for the general election that's coming up in November. I just want to ask you, what do you think your prediction is? I mean, just overall, how do you think the election's going to come out?
You know, gosh, I've never been so rattled by the amount of chaos that I've ever seen in a presidential election, right? One day, I think, you know, all the people conspiring against Trump are going to make sure that Biden, you know, gets to return for another term. You know, the next day, President Biden loses his way on a stage again, and I think there's just no way they're going to reelect this guy, you know. So I really struggle. But I will say this about Trump. He just keeps coming back. He's like Jason in Friday the 13th. Like, hey, nobody ever gets indicted for a felony and gets to keep running. And, oh, yeah, well, here's five felonies. Here's six felonies. Here's seven felony indictments. People have become convinced, and rightly so, to a degree for sure, that he's being unfairly hounded by using the courts to take him down. And so what normally would kill any candidate has had the other effect. You know, it's boomeranged and certainly catapulted him through the primary.
Rob, you're a music guy. You know, a lot of music trivia. Wasn't there a group called Chumbawamba, and they had this song called Tub Thumping? And it was, you know, the line goes, I get knocked down, but I get up again. You're never going to keep me down. You know, it was, you know, a very popular song. That comes to mind every time I think of Trump. And I think that's what people really hate about him. It's not the policies so much, because his policies aren't really out of, you know, the Republican mainstream. In fact, he's probably more centrist than a lot of more conservative candidates have been. They just can't stand it that they throw everything, including the kitchen sink, and he just never stops. You know, he's the Terminator. You know, he will not stop. And it drives people absolutely crazy. And I think that's also, interestingly, what a lot of his supporters like about him, because here's a guy that you can just kick him and hit him, run him over with your car, and he's going to stand up again. And it makes the elections really unpredictable, really interesting, but also really chaotic. And so, you know, I'm trying to nail you down on a prediction. If you asked me that question, I would just shrug because I have no clue. I have no clue.
It's just so hard for me to pick, because there's so many factors at play. And Trump has proven himself to be so resilient to what would normally kill any candidate, right? So here's the funny part about this. The Democrats clearly preferred Trump in 2016. During this past primary, they clearly preferred Trump again. They have themselves convinced that he's the beatable one. But boy, the last time they made that gamble, he won, and he might just do it again. So I don't know. You know, I think his supporters love the fact that he's a fighter, and that goes a long way. So I don't think I can make a good prediction. I just don't have a good idea. I can tell you that I don't want Biden to win. Now, but the congressional things are another matter. I think the House is in danger of flipping Democrat. the U.S. House. And my reason for that is simple. The U.S. House Republicans they're in chaos. I mean, they can't keep a Speaker of the House. You know, the guy makes one decision that their majority doesn't like. They go to chuck him out like they did the last one. They got backbenchers that scream and yell stuff from the back of the chamber all the time. And they don't look like a serious majority. And, you know, the Democrats, no matter what you say about them, they tend to stick together. And we saw that when Pelosi was Speaker of the House, that the Democrats simply lined up behind her to do everything they could to block Trump. And so I think the House is in danger. The Senate, boy, it's going to come down to just one or two races. That's what makes Sherrod Brown so important.
Well, what is the Chinese saying? You know, may you have an interesting life.
May you live an interesting time.
Rob, that's what we're doing. We're living in interesting times. So thanks for being on the podcast again, spending some time with us. And we'll be talking about elections and issuing more information about what's coming up in November as we move along. So, Rob, we'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you, Dean.
That's all for this episode of Keep and Bear Radio. If you enjoyed the podcast, I urge you to subscribe. And please subscribe to the Buckeye Firearms Association newsletter at buckeyefirearms.org. If you'd like to become a member and support the work of BFA, go to joinbfa.org. Use the discount code PODCAST to get $10 off your membership. That's joinbfa.org. We'll see you next time on Keep and Bear Radio.